So far, we had a very, very interesting conference. I would like to start with an announcement, which I've been asked to tell you, that anybody who have a mobile telephone should switch it off. That will not interfere with our mics here. We have three prominent speakers this afternoon, and every one of them will take between 15 and 20 minutes for his presentation. We'll start with Professor Abdullah Shaiji, colleagues of mine personally, and his Kuwait University Political Science Department. He will speak on the subject of the future U.S. engagement in the Gulf and the emergence of non-Western competition of the region. Abdullah, the floor is for you. Thank you. 20 minutes to start, please.
Thank you, Dr. Mohammed Al-Rumaihi. First of all, it gives me great pleasure to be attending this conference and participating in this this panel with my distinguished panelist and the well-distinguished friend, Dr. Rumaihi. And today the topic is about the future engagement of the United States and the role of non-Western powers in the region, and especially over the oil resources. The Gulf region has gained a lot of significance and importance in the last few decades because of what it has. Now, the soft power, the problem with this region is that it lacks an indigenous balance of power that has kept this region at this what we've witnessed in the last three decades of three major wars that have propelled the whole world into action, whether it was the Iraq-Iran war, whether it was the war to occupy Saddam Hussein's occupation of Kuwait and the concomitant results of liberating Kuwait, or the Iraq, the American war in Iraq that's going on now for the seventh year as of the 20th of this month. If we really need to read the future, I think we should read what has been published recently by the United States National Intelligence Council to give us some kind of a precursor regarding where are we heading, not only in the region, but what are the dynamics of forces and changes that could shape the future world. The National Intelligence Council published back in November of last year, just 2 months before President Obama took office, a very chilling and very sobering analysis and assessment, unclassified report, stating that the international system as constructed following the Second World War will be almost unrecognizable by 2025, owing to four factors: the rise of emerging powers, a globalizing economy, three, historic transfer of relative wealth and economic power from west to east, and fourth, the growing influence of non-state actors. So these are the variables and these are the dynamics that could shape the future, in my opinion. By 2025, the international system will be a global multipolar one, which means there is enough room for other non-Western countries, especially as Dr. Jandran this morning, we argued and we discussed it, that there is room now for maybe even the 21st century could be, for the optimist, an Asian century rather than anything else.
Do you want
else.
To be in the screen? First one.
This one?
This one.
This one. Yeah. So the U.S. National Intelligence Council envisages a future world marked by diminished U.S. power, dwindling resources, and more people. The U.S. will still have a role to play in the Middle East and Asia, despite also what's going on now in the United States, with the Obama administration, preoccupation with the economic meltdown and the stimulus packages and the fight with the Republicans in Congress to pass these bills. The United States' future role and engagement in the region, as we stated, will be less dominant power in the future. This is the assessment by the United States Intelligence Council, not by any other source or any other analysis by any institutions, east or west, but American. As I said, in November, they issued this analysis, this assessment. Even in the military realm, where the U.S. will continue to possess considerable advantage in 2025, advances by others in science and technology, expanded adoption of irregular warfare tactics, so there will be a more constraint, in a way, on regarding U.S. roles in the future. Now, the other point I would like to make is that the economic growth that will be witnessing in the future, as the report stated, in terms of size, speed, and directional flow, transfer of global wealth and economic power now underway roughly from west to east is without precedent. And this is phenomenal. The first visit by a Secretary of State since the 60s was done to the east, to East Asia, to China, and to South Korea, and to Japan, and not to the allies of the United States, the Western European countries. That is an indication that there is a shift now from the Atlantic to the Pacific, that we in the region should really be aware of. And as the statistics I'm going to show, and this morning was even indicated by the presentation by our friend Dr. Gendron, more trade is being done now by the Gulf countries, GCC states, with Asia rather than with the West. And that's probably the sign of the time or the sign of the future. Oil and gas transition from oil toward natural gas in the future, and coal and other alternative is also something that we should really take it very seriously. The bottom line here is that the world will be in the midst of a fundamental energy transition away from oil toward natural gas and coal and other alternatives. Now, moving towards multipolar order, there is, as you know, during the Cold War, we had a bipolar order since the fall of the Soviet Union and communism in East Europe and Soviet Union. United States dominated the international arena in a very unipolar approach, especially under President George W. Bush, with his doctrine and preemptive wars and 9/11, terrorism, and what have you, and splitting the world with us or against us. And in a way, that was interpreted in the Arab and Muslim world mainly as a war against Islam rather than against terrorism. We'll be glad to hear now that the Obama administration has gotten rid of this terminology, but I don't know how much in substance, rather in the style. No more talks in the United States will be, according to Washington Post, yesterday's issue, of global war on terrorism, but emergencies be overseas or something. I did not read it. I heard it in Arabic. So if somebody knows the term, he could tell us the new term that will be used by this administration. The new reality in this day and age is that the new world order is defined more by an increasingly multipolar order with many middle rising and major powers. And here comes the Asian side of the story, and the Russian that nobody had talked about, at least while I was in presence and listening to the speakers this morning, the role of the rising resurgent Russia and its interest, historical interest and future interest in our region. Greater Asian regionalism will be forming possibly by 2025, would have global implications. Financial situation could also help in pushing the Asians. We have now three trade blocks, North America, Europe, and East Asia. U.S. and other powers are regional, and regional countries are aware of this shift. Russians seems to determined also to play a role in the region that we have to factor it in. It was very ironic a couple of days ago, quoted by Reuters, a American NATO general stated something very, very obvious, but it was remarkable that he stated it in front of the Armed Services Committee in the United States Senate. Russia seeks to weaken the U.S. and Western alliance, according to NATO general. Russia seems determined, and I'm quoting here, to see Euro-Atlantic security institutions weakened and has shown a readiness to use economic leverage and military force to achieve its aims. General Craddock, NATO's supreme allied commander in Europe, told the U.S. Senate's Armed Services Committee, their actions in Georgia in August 2008 and with European natural gas supplies in January 2009 suggest that their overall intent may be to weaken European solidarity and systematically reduce U.S. influence. That was quoted by Reuters March 24, 2009. So, are we moving toward internationalizing Gulf security? From all indications, it seems that that's the case, but it's a long-term goal rather than an imminent one. The Americans are continue to dominate the region, as we stated this morning. Also, the Chinese and the Indians are hesitant. They do not have the projection of power. They don't have the capabilities. And there are a lot of fundamental problems for us in the Gulf to see that there is a role for China or there is a role for India in the foreseeable future due to many reasons. Maybe due, as I was discussing with my friend Greg Gauss, who I'm glad to see he's here with us in this room, for not bringing their Pakistan-Indian problems to the Gulf, or for the huge number of the Indian population, expatriate population in the region that we look at that could be something as a minus rather than a positive approach. Plus, who's going to initiate this internationalizing of the Gulf? We're not interested at this point to do it. We would like to, as GCC countries, to spread our eggs into more than one basket. But at this stage, all the GCC countries have signed up security arrangements with the United States. There is now some kind of fear or concerns about two things with the American, the new American administration. It's clear policy vis-a-vis Iraq, the withdrawal. How would that impact the security, stability, and the future of Iraq? How will Iranians play a role there? How will terrorism, Al-Qaeda, and its franchised surrogates could seize the opportunity? But Obama administration at least quelled a bit or allayed our fears a bit when it insisted that there will be 50,000 American troops will continue to be present in Iraq even after the withdrawing of the combat troops. The other point that could be of concern for us in the region is that the U.S.-Iran relations, now it's still not formulated fully. They're still, in my opinion, waiting to see the results of the presidential elections in Iran that will take place next June. Now we see bilateral talks from afar. We see multilateral approach through inviting Iran to the international conference over Afghanistan, or discussing some issues in a multilateral fashion with the Europeans. But I don't think there is going to be any rapprochement or any joint or bilateral relationship or discussions between the Iranians and the Americans. Although there are some good signs and signals, the Nehru's message by Obama was astonishing and was well received by the region, but by the Iranians it was predicted that they will just brush it off and were not interested in it. And it's ironic that today, just a few months after Bush administration left office, the Iranians are putting the conditions, not the Americans. It's the other way around. Before the Americans used to put the conditions, you have to stop enriching uranium before we can allow you to come and sit and talk. As Secretary Rice said, freeze the enrichment of uranium and we can meet with Muttaki anywhere, at any place or at any time. Now it's the other way around. Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, is telling the Obama administration, you should change your style and substance and not only your style to receive your extended hand. So now it's more shifting, it's more dynamic at stake. So internationalizing Gulf security, although it is probably in its infancy, although it's probably something that we would like to see, but still it's not something that we could see anytime soon because of these hindrances, because of these complications, and because of the psyche and the mindset that we still have. I mean, we look at the Americans and the West as the, for 200 years, they were the major outside powers that played a major role in shaping the region, whether it was the Portuguese, the Dutch, or the Brits, and then after that, the Americans. So the Asian issue is really not an issue that we are now talking about. The rise of China is something that we have really to think more than the Indian approach. Chinese, now they are playing a different approach. Deng Xiaoping, four character phrases, as the Economist put it last in this last issue. China should keep low profile, not take the lead, watch developments patiently, keep its capabilities hidden. All of this, I think, now is a new ball game for them. Now there's a new thinking and rethinking. The oil factor, we talked about in previous sessions, but oil has been a major factor in determining Gulf security. As most of you know, the lifeline for EU, Japan, China, and India is this region. 60-80% of their oil comes from this region. So any supply shock from the 5 minutes. Okay. The lingering question is, how long these rising stars, especially China, Japan, India, and South Korea, will acquiesce to such arrangements and won't demand a role in Gulf security to safeguard their precious commodities? I think it's a two-way street. We have also to think about that, not only them, the others, the rising stars, as Farid Zakaria called them, but even us, how deep and how much and how strategically we're thinking about making some moves on our parts, also the GCC, especially regarding the divergent views that was were precipitated by the Bush administration. And last year it was a very watershed year in the relationship between the GCC countries and the United States over divergent views of Gulf security. It was, for somebody who follows the relationship closely between the United States and the GCC countries, I was puzzled to hear the strong criticism by the GCC foreign ministers against the United States, and that was done, that was in April of last year. In the report, the United States accuses its 8th annual trafficking in person tip, or as the Treasury Department calls it, modern day slavery. The GCC states responded against the United States by saying the information in that report, this is a joint statement by GCC foreign ministers, the information aims to practice unjustified pressure for political ends and ask the United States to revise its unfriendly policy toward the GCC countries. And that statement by itself speaks volume of the strain of the relationship over the Bush administration approach regarding that that issue. Also, there were some other remarks. Gulf security was and will continue to be an American affair. Secretary Gates said that in Hawar al-Manama, Manama dialogue in 2007, while the Bahraini foreign minister stated that to internationalize Gulf security and we should not be an exclusive affair of one player or even of the one superpower as the Qatari emir or and the Qatari foreign minister. I think I'm running out of time, but just to conclude here is that I think there is the United States going to continue to be the supreme and major player in this region for the next foreseeable future. There is room because of the multipolar world that we are now witnessing unfolding in the last few years, and it will gain more speed in the next few years. There will be room, especially with because of the economic downturn and the cost of the American presence in the region, could apply, and the increased demand for energy, especially in the future, liquefied gas and moving from oil towards gas, there could be room for other players in the region, especially in a multipolar world, like the Russians, like the Chinese, and maybe to a lesser extent the Indians, to see some kind of a role in Gulf security. And it's for us, it's a win-win situation, I think, to spread out our eggs into more than one basket, to also not to be blind about our fundamental and strategic relationship at the same time with the West. But that doesn't mean that we should not diversify our concern and relationship, especially the trade and the investment that could go towards Asia could be also another layer of support. And as we're doing it with NATO now, the ICI, the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative, it does not take away any of our bilateral security arrangements and agreements that we've signed with the Americans. It could be the same down the road at the long term. That could be an added value, that could be another layer of support and protection, because it's a win-win situation. It's a two-way street. They will safeguard their interests and contribute to the access of oil and gas, and we at the same time could have more strategic alliance and relationship with the Eastern Bloc, with the Eastern countries, rather than just keep it on one-way street level with the Western side. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Abdullah Shaiji. I think Dr. Abdullah have painted the international scene for us very eloquently, and probably we'll move to Dr. Christian Orton, and he will talk to us on the emerging challenge to the internal security and external stability. You have 20 minutes, please.
Thank you. I'd like to take a different angle to the current Gulf security and think about how it's evolving in response to a range of emerging and increasingly longer-term challenges to national and regional security. And by examining a range of increasingly non-military issues, I've aimed to draw out the distinction between the internal and external dimensions of security and how they relate to each other. These issues include demographic trends and structural imbalance in socioeconomic indicators, the political economy of resource distribution in several of the Gulf states, and the impact of environmental degradation and climate change on the region, which we've been touched on this morning. Professor Bazan touched on it, which I agree is an increasingly a vital longer-term challenge, which doesn't seem to be accorded the due significance as of yet, especially as a security issue rather than an environmental issue. I'll argue that changing political economies in the Gulf are straining traditional channels of state-society interaction, and they're also complicating traditional strategies for co-opting support through the spread of wealth. This will increase as resource depletion in several of the Gulf countries, such as Bahrain and Oman, mean they will move into the post-oil era sooner rather than later. For example, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia do not have the same pressing challenges facing them as the others. Therefore, if left unchecked or inadequately tackled, these issues do have the potential to strike at the heart of the social contract and redistributive mechanisms which have bound state society together. And they could, if not tackled, leave a legacy of fractured internal polities which are then more vulnerable to future external and global threats from issues such as climate change. These issues, therefore, are important to the long-term security and stability in the Arabian Peninsula, as equally as important over the long term as the more immediate issues, for example, from the Iranian nuclear program, the post-occupation dynamics of Iraq, and the material and ideational threat from transnational terror to the region as elsewhere. There's also the idea of regime security, which is in common with many other developing countries around the world, is often conflated with national security. Ruling elites in all the GCC states have hitherto pursued successful strategies of survival, which enable them to ride out the huge changes that accompanied the transition into the oil era and to retain control over the processes of state formation over the last century. And they'll need to do the same to transition out of the oil era as well. External security alliances, both bilaterally with the United States and multilaterally through the creation of the GCC, have also met internal needs by reinforcing regime security. But the Gulf remains an extremely volatile sub-region, as Professor Al-Shaji said, three major conflicts in the last three decades, and it retains multiple and interlinking threats to internal and external security. It did not share in the transformation of security that occurred in Eastern Europe or Latin America during the 1990s, where security became linked to issues of political and economic legitimacy and the emergence of new concepts of cooperative security, which was associated with a shift away from realist approaches predicated on zero-sum notions of national security. Again, no such comparative shift occurred in the Gulf, which has seen three major wars in 30 years. At the same time, the global security environment has shifted profoundly in recent decades. It means that future security in the Gulf and elsewhere is likely to be affected more by what happens within states than by the relations between them. Many of the so-called new wars are conflicts within society rather than between states. This also ties into a move towards redefining security as older demarcation between internal and external dimensions breaks down in a world of globalization, transnational interdependencies, and cross-border flows of people, money, and legal and illicit goods. I'll just begin briefly by detailing how the regional response to Iraq and Iran and the issue of transnational terrorism has been shaped by concerns over the potential impact of external events on sharpening regional political instability and state-society tension domestically. The unfolding of events in Iraq and Iran has been viewed primarily through the prism of the Shiite Crescent, which was said to run from Iran through Iraq and the eastern province of Saudi Arabia to Lebanon. This has been very much the discourse, even though it is ahistorical in reality, as Ryder has demonstrated in his work. The Iraqi Shiites, for example, have shown a much stronger attachment to Iraqi nationalism rather than being just a tool of any transnational actors. This has affected both the regional suspicion of the new Iraqi government, the Maliki government, as a source of multiple threats and a reluctance to engage with it politically and economically, which has paradoxically enabled Iran to take the lead in doing precisely just that. It's also, to a degree, resulted in the conflation of Iranian meddling with and Shiite loyalties into an amorphous threat, which often has viewed Shiite communities in several of the Gulf states as potential fifth columnists, notably in Bahrain or in Saudi Arabia, where officials have feared the politicization of Shia community and sought to deflect demands for participation and inclusion. An increasingly important, in my view, security risk is the return of Iraq insurgency veterans from the insurgency to the Arabian Peninsula, and it exposes another example of the linkages between external and internal dimensions. And this was highlighted in January when the two former Saudi Arabia detainees from Guantanamo Bay emerged as leaders of Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Saad al-Shikri and Mohammed al-Awfi spent 5 months in Saudi Arabia's much vaunted rehabilitation centers following their release from Guantanamo in 2007, and they were deemed ready for reintegration into Saudi society in May last year. And their reappearance in Yemen strikes a damaging blow to the counter-terrorism strategy, which had been presented as a soft approach, as an emphasis on intellectual security,
and an innovative new strategy in the struggle against violent extremism. And the link with Yemen adds weight to the growing evidence that extremists and groups linked to Al-Qaeda are reconstituting themselves in Yemen following their tactical and operational defeat in Saudi Arabia in 2003-2004, and taking advantage of the ungoverned spaces and security gaps caused by the contraction of state control in Yemen and the burgeoning socio-economic challenges which are hastening state failure in the southwestern flank of the Arabian Peninsula. Yemenis indeed form the largest non-Saudi contingent of terror suspects arrested in the kingdom since 2003. Yemeni-based cells have been implicated in planned attacks on vital oil installations inside Saudi Arabia. Three of the six suicide bombers who targeted the US embassy in Sana'a in September 2008 had recently returned from Iraq and were reported to have attended Al-Qaeda training camps in southern Yemen. And indeed, I would argue the escalating social, economic and political crises in Yemen are a growing threat to regional security and require regional and international engagement to meet the longer-term challenge posed by a soaring population, dwindling natural resources and contraction of regime or authority. I don't see that this has yet happened at the GCC level beyond formalities, including Yemen in various subcommittees. And hard security responses such as tightening border controls and attempting to insulate themselves from any overspill of instability. I think much more engagement with Yemen is necessary to try and prevent this slide into state collapse. Moving towards longer term challenges to regional security, I wish to underscore the vital importance of integrating security with processes of political reform and economic liberalisation and diversification which are currently underway in all GCC states. Indeed, as the GCC states expand their ambitious projects of economic diversification, the security of supply of and access to resources will become vital to maintaining regime legitimacy and become a strategic end in themselves. Food, water and energy security will emerge, indeed they are emerging, as major priorities as rapidly rising populations, both natural growth and expatriate influx, and heavy industrialization place growing strains on existing natural and infrastructural resources. In addition, declining water tables throughout the region and competing demands from agricultural, domestic and industrial users, for example, this led Saudi Arabia to announce plans to halt its grain production schemes by 2016. And in November 2008, a report by the Islamic Development Bank found that average annual water availability per capita in the Middle East is just one-third of what it was in 1960, and is predicted to halve again by 2050 to just above the subsistence level. The threat remains that the fragile political economy of resource distribution in the Gulf could falter under the strain of soaring demand and contracting supply. Demand for electricity and water is already stretched towards capacity as infrastructure struggles to keep up with existing demand. And in this worst-case scenario, regimes will be unable to maintain the standards of living that citizens have become used to over the last 30, 40 years, and the social contract could become frayed and liable to renegotiation, particularly as younger generation, you have this youth bulge, large numbers of young people who have no point of comparison with what went before, and they increasingly take the welfare state as a right of citizenship. That could be something in the long term. Social tensions could flare if governments are unable to maintain a system of subsidies of food, water or electricity and have to introduce greater levels of taxation, increasingly direct taxation. Gulf states may soon have to introduce charges for power and water as global competition for regional oil and gas supplies undercuts the provision of cheap supplies to local markets. The impact over the last 6 months of plunging oil prices has also forced governments to revise downwards their budget forecasts and to scale back on ambitious development projects, particularly in Dubai. It's also significant that labour unrest in Dubai and Bahrain, even to a small degree in Qatar over the last year, has underscored the importance of maintaining economic security, as labourers have protested against rapidly rising inflation in the first half of 2008 and the withholding of benefits by their employers. The danger for the Gulf states is that the double impact of prolonged low oil prices and the global financial downturn will stoke social tensions and politicise these issues if their governments are seen to be unable to respond effectively. This ties into the second larger challenge, which is the socio-economic and demographic trends in the peninsula. Dwindling oil reserves in Bahrain, Oman and Yemen and a demographic time bomb of an imbalanced population in which 70% are under the age of 30 pose profound socio-economic challenges to the welfare models of state-society relations. This is compounded by the comparative failure of many of the economic diversification projects to provide the large-scale employment opportunities for local citizens, for qualified local citizens, and their dependence on foreign labourers has increased, while and underemployment remains a significant problem in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, for example. Indeed, a study by McKinsey in November 2007 laid bare the scale of the challenge posed by mounting unemployment in Bahrain, Oman and Saudi Arabia. It estimated that real unemployment has exceeded 15% and that the figure rose to 35% in the 16 to 24 age group. And it found that the public sector was no longer able to guarantee employment to citizens entering the job market. Therefore, the longer-term threat, if nothing is, I mean, if these challenges are not addressed adequately, is that these redistributive states will find themselves vulnerable to erosion of the ruling bargain and loss of legitimacy if mechanisms for co-opting support begin to break down, and the impact of structural economic problems, high indigenous unemployment, could fuel anger and resentment at regimes if they're unable to compensate through wealth transfers to disaffected citizens. I'd like to end with climate change, a few words on climate change, which is a potentially very severe threat to security in the Gulf, as elsewhere, partly because patterns of settlement and development will be especially vulnerable to any rise in sea levels. Professor Bazan mentioned the islands. I mean, that's not just the small palm islands, for example, the entire island of Bahrain. Comparative empirical studies from elsewhere have also indicated how climate change can drive cross-border disputes, can politicize access to resources, and can exacerbate existing conflicts, as in Darfur. And the Gulf contains numerous potential fault lines, Arab, Persian, Sunni, Shia, urban, tribal, or citizen expatriate, which could fracture into conflict if the political economy of resource distribution begins to falter. Of course, the big issue here in Kuwait is that the eventual opening later this year of the Iranian nuclear reactor in Bushehr carries with it the possibility for devastating environmental and economic impacts of any accident or incident which would cause catastrophic disruption to patterns of habitation and development on both sides of the Gulf. I mean, you need no reminding that Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and the eastern coastline of Saudi Arabia are all within 200 kilometres of the reactor, closer to the reactor than Tehran, and they depend on desalinated water from the Gulf for 80% of water supplies. So any leak of radiation or accident would have devastating local consequences, ranging from destruction of marine ecosystems to contamination of food stocks or dislocation of development and industrial activity, worst case to large-scale refugee flows. This aside, though, environmental degradation and climate change have yet to feature adequately in regional security discourse, or so I've found. The Gulf states have some of the highest levels of per capita energy consumption or per capita carbon emission in the world in this context of heavy industrialization and mega projects. And the long-term security threat from climate change doesn't seem to be an issue on the security agenda, which remains focused on more short-term issues. It's interesting, in December 2008, the UK Secretary of Defence, John Hutton, in the Manama Dialogue, listed climate change as one of the three new threats to Gulf security, alongside the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and the provision of terrorist havens in failed states. And it remains to be seen whether this will have any discernible impact in the region. So some difficult challenges do lie ahead, I would argue. The Gulf regimes must reformulate their welfare states, which were constructed in the 1960s and 70s, in a period of comparatively lower population and high wealth per capita. They must manage the transition to post-redistributive models of governance and address the systemic structural problems and socio-economic composition, much of which is already happening. Simultaneously, the impact of the processes of globalization and their political and economic opening up will present new material and ideational linkages between the internal and external dimensions of security. And at a regional level, just to end on a regional note, the GCC must find a workable balance between reliance on the United States as an external security guarantor and the creation of a regional security infrastructure that can provide greater stability than the balance of power dynamic hitherto has done. This may best be served, any number of options, but it could be served by engaging with Iran in a possibly resurgent post-occupation Iraq while regulating their power within some form of inclusive security arrangement. This need not entail the expansion of the GCC to include Iran and Iraq, which is unfeasible at present and likely to remain so for the foreseeable future. It could, for example, take the form of a network of fora and mechanisms for comprehensive and cooperative security based loosely on the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. But that's just a thought for the long term. Thank you.
Dr. Kirsten, what gloomy picture you have painted to us this afternoon. Okay. Now we will move to probably a better picture by our friend Ryder Visser, who have written a book on Basra. We have an expert on Basra here, and he will talk to us on the failure Basra Federalism Initiative sometime in the past. The floor is for you.
Thank you very much.
20 minutes.
I'm extremely grateful to Petros and to OLC for inviting me. I'm going to talk about the failed Basra Federalism Initiative implications for Gulf security. And I'm sure you will find it somewhat exotic that someone from Norway is terribly interested in the Basra Federalism Initiative. So I want to take 5 minutes or so just to explain why I have this curious interest in Basra Federalism. This began in the 1990s. The Balkans were on fire in Europe. Yugoslavia was disintegrating. Everyone in Europe was talking about what would happen to Iraq. Some people said that Iraq was soon about to become torn apart. It would disintegrate. Shiites against Sunnis, against Kurds. Others say, no, Iraqi nationalism is strong. There's no problem here at all. One contention against another. And I thought it was strange that no one had tried to look into the history of attempts to separate the south of Iraq from the rest of the country. So when I came across a reference to something called the Basra separatism movement in the 1920s, I thought this was quite interesting. This could be some sort of test case for the strength of Iraqi nationalism. So I tried to find out as much as I possibly could about the Basra separatist movement in the 1920s and what on earth it was. And when I heard about this in the 1990s, I thought it would be something like this, something about Shiite separatism, the creation of a separate Shiite country or something. But that was not what it was. This map is a fantasy. Some say it's been created by the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, but the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq will not acknowledge it. So it was not something like this. What I found was something like this. The Basra separatist movement in the 1920s was an attempt not by Shiites, but by a multi-sectarian coalition, mostly merchants, rich merchants and date garden owners of Basra, who wanted to have some sort of special regime for Basra as an autonomous entity, possibly in federation with the rest of Iraq under British protection. It was headed by persons like this one, Ahmad Pasha Asane, who together with other merchants, familiar names like Abdel Latif Pasha Al-Mandil, got together in this attempt. So these were not Shiites, they were Sunnis, many of them from Zubair, others were Christians, Jews, a couple of Persian merchants, but not Arab Shiites, but Persian Shiites. The Shiites mostly remained aloof from this project. So this was a commercial, cosmopolitan, anti-sectarian undertaking. And they were not interested in separating all of the south of Iraq, but just Basra. Basra north to Al-Qurna, and that's it. And they tried, and they failed. They failed miserably. They could not persuade the British, nor could they persuade the majority of Basrawis to support this undertaking. So I concluded, I was working on this project, and I concluded that this test case had shown that in Basra, Iraqi nationalism is strong, it has historical roots and so on. And I was in the middle of completing my book, which also exists in an Arabic translation called Al-Basra wa Hulm al-Jumhuriyya al-Khalishiyya. And I was writing it at around 2004, and I was writing about the strong Iraqi nationalism in Basra. And then something happened. A friend told me there's something going on in Basra. There is some sort of federalism movement in Basra. I said, no, I'm completing this book now and writing up the conclusion. Nationalism is strong, believe me, and so on. But it kept coming back to me that there's something going on in Basra. So gradually I heard about this movement to create the federal region of Basra, Iqlim al-Basra. From 2005 to 2008, I tried to make sense of this movement. What on earth is it? Is it significant? It made a lot of noise. But how does it compare with Iraqi nationalism and so on? In January this year, I got an answer to that, because there was a referendum, or there was an attempt to have a referendum, but it didn't get so that far. There was a petition movement, and they got 30 to 35,000 signatures in favor of Iqlim al-Basra. So I'm asking myself, and this is what I want to discuss in some detail with, and also with some regional implications, does this mean that Iraqi nationalism is very firm and has a lot of appeal in Basra or not? So just to flesh this out a little bit, what is this Basra federalism initiative? We need to put it in context. It's the one in the middle here. There have been some other rumors about federalism and attempts to create federal regions south of Baghdad. On the left hand you have the region of the south project, Iqlim al-Janoub, Basra, Maysan and Dikar, and to the right you have the region of the center and the south project, Iqlim al-Wast al-Janoub, and now they call it Iqlim Janoub Baghdad, which is of course the Hakim project. But the Basra region is the only one that had even got to the point where they started collecting signatures. So it's the one in the middle I'm talking about. Who are they? Well, familiar faces. Mohammed al-Wali, the former, or still governor, but now he lost quite severely in the last elections of the Fadila party. As we've already seen, Wael Abdelatif, who used to be with al-Wafaq, and he has his own party called Hizb ad-Dawla. Amr al-Faiz from the Tajammu al-Adala wal-Wahda, which has its origin in the Sheikhi community of Basra, but which has managed to appeal a little bit more broadly, I think. Those are the leading Basra federalists. What do they want? Here are a couple of quotes. I'll run through them very quickly so that I don't take a lot of time. This is, again, Wael Abdelatif. The model that we would follow is that of the United Arab Emirates, where each state has the freedom to grow and prosper, while its center would provide the necessary support to the states. Here is a long quote from Hassan al-Rashid, who used to be the governor of Basra before in 2004, before Fadila. The interesting thing in this quote, and he's with Hakim's party, but this is before the big Shiite federalism idea. The interesting thing in this quote has to do with oil. He talks about in the United Arab Emirates there's also Abu Dhabi, which has oil and is the richest of the provinces or emirates that form the UAE. 50% of its oil income goes to the emirate, and the rest is shared with the central government. So there's this feeling, at least among some of the Basrawi federalists, that Basra has a special entitlement to its oil, because Basra, as you know, holds maybe 60 or 70% of the resources, total resources in Iraq. Again, a quote. This is also interesting because it talks about the comparisons that people who support the Basra federalism project are making with the rest of the Gulf. Basra, this coastal city which overlooks the richest bay in the world, sits on a sea of oil, borders on three countries, possesses millions of date palms and acres of agricultural land and abounds with historical treasures. Basra owns all this, and yet there is no strategic vision for the city. Basra does not have a single building that sizes up for the smallest building in Dubai. There's not a single road like Zayed Road, and so on and so forth. And this aspect about oil, I think, is particularly interesting. So I'll give a few more quotes on that. This is the Muhammad Al-Wali again referring to oil and a strike among the oil workers and saying it has regionalist ambitions. And this is a very common refrain among the Basra federalists. Basra single-handedly finances all of Iraq, and had it not been for this city, Iraq would have come to a standstill. And yet, in terms of finances, Basra is treated as if it were another ordinary governorate. Now, the project failed. They got 35,000 votes, and there are 2 or 3 million people in Basra. So something is wrong here. The Basra Federalists had problems. And I want to say a few things about what sort of problems they've encountered. And I think the first of them has to do with Iraqi identity, which is often dismissed, particularly in the West, I guess. Iraq is the artificial country that has no historical basis and so on. I have a map here. Do you know by any chance when this map was published? Any guesses?
Late 18th century.
Well, it's not that early. It's 1860s, but I still find it to be quite interesting because it's not entirely dissimilar, I would say, to the modern state of Iraq. This is the Wilayat of Baghdad in the 1860s, when it was, as you can see, quite big, from Basra to well north of Baghdad and towards Mosul. And I think if we look, I mean, it's difficult to make these administrative maps, but there's certainly maps in the past that are quite interesting. For some reason, Western historians in particular have focused on the one from 1884 to 1914, when there was a tripartite division into three Ottoman vilayets. But the 1860s, for example, there was a big Baghdad vilayet, and again in the early 19th century, in the late 18th century, you had also this configuration with Basra and Baghdad and Mosul all as one. And also in the past history, you have different variations of this theme. So it's not only the tripartite partition. You could say that the idea of some sort of entity governed from Baghdad, it does have a certain historical resonance. So I think this has been a problem for the Basra Federalists because they underestimate Iraqi nationalism in a way in Basra. Again, I want to, if I have time for it, I want to just read through this quote, which is also interesting. This is from the 1890s, a Basra historian. He's talking about the so-called artificial country. He's talking about in Iraq, Basra suffered as other states and Bedouin tribes fought over it, raising new standards and sometimes proclaiming their independence, and lots of problems. All of this would have gone on, but not for Suleiman Khan's care for Iraq, as it made the provinces of Basra and Baghdad a single province. And he's talking about the attacks by the Shahs of Iran on Iraq, an historian writing in 1819. So Basra, Iraqi nationalism in Basra does possess certain historical roots, and I think this is why we see things like this today. Federalism was a problem since the writing of the constitution began and so on. Iraqis will unite against federalism. No to federalism. This board is something that was created, or this banner that you can see, it's by tribal sheikhs who are signing up against federalism during this latest campaign. And again, more examples of Iraqi nationalism by Basra intellectuals. And this had an impact, I think, on the Federalists. They did have a problem, because they've tried to create a second Kurdistan down in Basra, but they are not in agreement with the Kurds when it comes to all issues. This is also why Abdel Latif, but this time he signals that he has a problem with the Kurds. He's criticizing the Kurds for pushing the Kirkuk issue. So he's critical of the ones that have implemented the Kurdistan idea. And this is also why Abdel Latif, he says that the central government should actually have a strong role when it comes to oil. And there's this complicated argument on the part of the Basra Federalist that somehow the reason they are creating the region of Basra is to save Iraq from fragmentation along sectarian lines. And this is a very complicated argument, but it's what they are saying. We shall work to implement single governorate federalism in order to preserve the territorial unity of Iraq and avert the opening up for any anchorage or base that in the future would support the partition of Iraq. The idea being that sectarian federalism is more dangerous than regional or geographical federalism. And again, this is the brother of the governor, Ismail al-Awaili, who is saying this very explicitly. The project of a 9-government southern region, which Iski and Abdulaziz al-Hakim support, is a sectarian project backed by Iran and Britain, not sure about that, in order to weaken Iraq, partition it, and steal its revenue. Basra will remain the port of Iraq and the example of its Arabness to stop the Iranian influences. So there is this sort of... there is a bit of tension in the Basra federalism discourse, because there are many Iraqi nationalists who simply don't agree with this interpretation, that it would be better for the unity of Iraq to subdivide it into smaller entities, larger rather than 3 entities. Many Iraqi nationalists, of course, don't want to have any federal regions apart from Kurdistan. And the final sort of weakness that I like to point out when it comes to the Basra federalism project has to do with strategy. They are quite disunited internally. I was quite shocked when I came across this quote from the president of the local Kurna council. You probably know where, Mamilio, you know where that is. Just north of Basra, at the junction of the Tigris and the Euphrates, there's a small town called Al-Kurna. And the president of the Baladia Council in Kurna says, "The inhabitants of the area are in favor of federalism if it leads to growth and provides us with a fair share of the oil of Basra. But the counties of northern Basra have considered joining together as a separate governorate if the current poor conditions persist. There could be another governorate north of Basra, consisting of Kurna, Medina, and Deir, with Kurna as its center." So this problem with internal sub-separatisms or sub-federalisms inside the Basra project is something that sounds very similar to what was the problem in the 1920s, when after a while the people of Zubair had different priorities than the people of the city of Basra and so on. So, finally, we had this federalism initiative, it failed. So is the Basra federalism idea, is it dead or is it just sleeping? I'm trying to make sense of this, and maybe it's something we can leave for discussion, because I find it incredibly difficult to understand. Very clearly though, I mean, it was a big, big disappointment for the Basra federalists what happened in the initiative with so little support. There are some people suggesting that they still support the idea, but the time was not right. This is something I keep hearing. Certainly, one of the parties, the party of Amr al-Fayez, did quite well in the elections. It got 5.5% of the election, of the vote, or something like this. So, which is more than the number of signatures collected for the Federalism Initiative. So, suggesting that it's not entirely dead, but maybe the time is not right. What I find amazing about it is that much of the Basra Federalism project has been founded on a very firm anti-Iranian platform, and it's remarkable that it has not managed to attract any degree of interest in the Western world, where there is so much anti-Iranianism. But people in the West hardly know about the Basra Federalism, because these are Shiites mostly who truly reject Iranian influence. But they've not received much support in the West, which is sort of interesting, I find. And finally, at last, implications for the wider Gulf, because that was also what I was supposed to address. This model in Basra is quite dramatic in terms of implication for Gulf security. If suddenly Iraq can break down into smaller entities, I mean, what can happen along? There are other countries in the Gulf which have some of the similar issues that Iraq has. Could we envisage some sort of dramatically different state structure in the Gulf if this idea gains traction? This is just an example from Yemen, where there are certainly people in the Aden area that are interested in federalism. So, to conclude, this is the sort of map that has been circulating in America a lot about. You're absolutely right. Now, these are fantasies of Americans who do not know much about the region, but who like to strategize on behalf of it. And you see they have carved up Iraq in
Yemen whole.
You're right. This map, many of the ideas I think here are thoroughly discredited in the region already, especially anything that has to do with sectarian federalism. That is a no-no. I mean, you've seen the reactions to Hakim's project. It just faded away. So that isn't so surprising, I would say, that nothing came out of it. But what we've had in Basra now, that is federalism in the more innocent variant of geographical non-sectarian patriotism language. It was supposed to have better prospects. It was modeled on the United Arab Emirates, which is seen by many Iraqis as an acceptable form of federalism. But it too failed, and failed quite miserably. So as of today, I would say the prospect of federalism spreading as some sort of virus, becoming another ism haunting the Gulf region, the prospect of that happening is not very strong right now, at least. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have three very interesting papers, and we have 15 minutes to go for our coffee break. So, be short, direct, and ask the question. Hamid.
Thank you so much. First, I have a commentary. Last month, I attended a lecture in Bahrain, and the subject was the development of the oil industry in Norway. Mm-hmm. And the speaker was an Iraqi from Basra. So it seems that you are coordinating places. The second thing is about the movement in the early 20s, which was behind separating Basra from Iraq, yes, towards the south, it was not really a movement to separate it as an independent state, more than of to relieve themselves from the influence of Baghdad. And I'm sure, Mr. Visser, you are aware about that those pictures which you showed for Assana al-Mandir, those families, they have more relatives in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia than relatives in north of Basra. Yeah. And their interest was more in concentrating on facilitating commerce between India and Basra. They thought that a move to separate or to give more independence to Basra will better off their existence in commerce and in trade, and especially in their relation to India and the rest. And by the way, you are in a place where historically has been very much connected to Basra. I can still arrange that you meet some of friends here whose first trip by airplane outside Kuwait was from Basra to Bombay or from Basra to Beirut and then Leh. So in Kuwait, you know, of course the young generation is not aware about that in Kuwait, but historically Kuwait has been very much integrated commercially and economically with Basra. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. Please? Yes. Yes. There's no mic? There's a mic, yes. Yes.
Thank you. I just had a couple of comments. Can anybody hear that?
Yeah. Yes.
A couple of comments, if I may, just quickly, on Radha's link to the UAE. It's striking, of course, and I think Radha made that fairly clear what he was saying, of course, that the parallel with Abu Dhabi is one that when it comes to the UAE case, it would be like having Basra very much in the driving seat of Iraq. The federalism which was agreed in the UAE, of course, is very much unlike the very active discussion that's going on in Iraq within the elements of its constitution and also amongst its various political groups. It's what I would call a very informal federalism. It was agreed that each emirate would own and manage the energy resources in its territory, which has benefited Abu Dhabi, and Dubai's resources and charges are obviously very limited. But nothing else was defined or laid down. And that seems to suit what is in many ways a loose association of leading families with some marital links between them, and a very informal politics amongst them, and a very depoliticized wider society, apart from some elements of the Muslim Brotherhood who have been, in my view, absorbed. So it's a very, very different situation in many senses, and a loose framework seems to have suited the UAE very well. Just a comment, if I can, to link to the comments made by Abdallah and also by Chris, very quickly. A missing element in thinking about internationalizing Gulf security is the extent to which the GCC countries, after all, massively armed and in some areas enhancing their own capabilities, should themselves be seen as an increasingly capable actor. The Saudis, as I understand it, have developed relatively significant naval capabilities. We know about the training of UAE pilots in terms of F-16s. We don't hear much discussion about GCC defence integration and purchasing on a common GCC-wide basis. That surely should be part of any discussion about security operations in the Gulf area. And just a final thing on Chris's element about the social contract. Absolutely. In terms of that sense of pressure, and I guess that must be Rai. You know, the Omanis have banned any foreign taxi drivers, and the Bahrainis are actually trying to tax foreign labour to some extent and use the money to try and train nationals, and Saudi Arabia feels the acute pressure with its 17 million population. I don't think that means that Qatar and the UAE should be glib about this because of their small populations, but clearly there are different responses to the kind of issues that you've raised.
There were three very interesting talks. Just to start off with, picking up from what Dr. Ulrichsen said, in the coming decades, sitting here in the Gulf, looking at that blue sea, there's trouble brewing across that sea, that beautiful blue ocean. And I think in the coming decades, that will characterize Gulf policy. Some say that Iran, or it has the potential to be that. And what is in English is like a thorn in the Gulf side. And I think in the coming decades, what the GCC countries have to look to, like the gentleman here said from Sharjah University, is to integrate their own security services. They can't, their own security potential. They can't keep relying on a big brother. And that's the dilemma for the Khalij. Do they swallow this Iranian threat? Do they exhaust diplomatic channels, or do they oppose this dilemma? Picking up on the gentleman from Norway, Dr. Visser's speech was two things. Kirkuk has the potential to be the richest city on earth. Take it resource-wise, Kirkuk is the richest city on earth. That's why it poses a big problem, taking that joke of an American map we just saw. Should a Kurdish free state occur then, it poses problems for this new government, this new Iraqi government. And building upon that from the Basra perspective, federalism always failed in Basra, because Basra is just that isolated bit of Iraq. And as I said, the whole movements are based on familial ties. I think it could have succeeded had the movement worked from an Ahwazi perspective. Ahwaz, as we know, is bordering next to Basra. 11% Iranian, let's not forget, 11% Arab, let's not forget Iran is. And had the Ahwazi movement been mobilized, the Arabs that live within Iran, then it would have given the Basrawi movement strategic depth, because there's a buffer between Basra and Iran. And I think that would have made a very interesting discussion to see what the Ahwazi perspective, how it would have bolstered the Basrawi movement. That's it.
Thank you very much. Lady Lowe, yes, please.
Yes, my question is with regards to internationalization of Gulf security. I was just wondering, what's China and India's incentive for entering into strategic military alliances with the GCC if you already have the US as the de facto guarantor of oil supplies? You can see from the GCC perspective, as has been mentioned, they don't want to have all their eggs in the same strategic basket. You don't have the political baggage associated, like we saw with the US reports. China obviously doesn't have a great human rights record, it's not going to bring that up. So why would China or India or East Asian countries be interested in that, and why would they not be content with sticking in the economic sphere instead of going to military strategic area?
Thank you. Gentlemen?
So my question is, I think mainly for Dr. Shadri, although obviously anyone can comment on it. There's this implicit assumption in everything starting from this morning, and I wasn't here yesterday, but I assume the same thread was continuing, that Iran is always going to be this threat. And I want to know why this conflict has been continuously seen as a zero-sum game between the GCC states and Iran. I strongly believe that in particular, the emerging generation is not entirely convinced that this is a zero-sum game. Or if they are convinced, it's a kind of latent, kind of passive going on with what they see around them. And I would bring up the example of nuclear technology. Iran would not be today be spoken of seriously as an emerging nuclear power were it not for the case that since the revolution in particular, and starting, let's say, about a generation before the revolution, there has been something of a scientific revolution in Iran. So, for example, the amount of Iranian-authored journals published in international scientific papers has increased something like sevenfold in the past 40 years or something. They're the 15th most active country in publishing theoretical physics papers. And if you can look at this from the perspective of the GCC states, which are actually suffering a very acute deficit and disorder in their educational standards, this is something we can actually learn from Iran. The militarization, the harnessing of wind power in Iran, in February of 2008, Iran announced that they had something like 500 megawatts worth of wind farms, which had just gone online. I think what gets lost in all of this very blinkered worldview is that Iran is not only developing nuclear weapons for the sake of having nuclear weapons and threatening the United States. Iran is actually transforming itself into a very modernized, very scientifically advanced country, relatively speaking, to the region. And given that there are points of natural alliance between Iran and the GCC states, for example, both would be threatened by in Israel, which is onto the teeth. Both have an interest in a reasonable price for the hydrocarbon wealth. Both have a reasonable interest in protecting the Gulf. there should be a time to seek an alliance with Iran instead of just seeing it as a threat at different levels.
Thank you very much. Because of the time constraint, we'll have a couple of questions. Yes?
Professor, University of Kurdistan. I'm interested in the discussion of federalism, and also I'd like to link it in a sense to the security issue, which has also been raised in this this panel and the earlier one today. And it seems to me that a key issue for Iraq and also for Gulf security is the different model of federalism which could be developed. Dr. Visser mentioned about the model of the United Arab Emirates seen by Iraqis as an acceptable form of federalism. I suppose the issue is that the different groups of Iraqis prefer different models of federalism. And I think, reading the other day, how an American had a role in drafting a key constitutional article. It was first devised in English, then translated into Arabic, and then translated back into an unofficial UN version. I just wanted to raise the issue of
the whole constitution was written in English first.
Really, yeah, this role of constitution building. It seems to me that this is a very significant issue. How can what version of federalization of natural resources? In the same way, the United States had a whole process of devising constitutional wrangling through its history. So Iraq is going through that now, and a return to a unified, unitary, centralized Iraqi state would only, in my view, bring more conflict. I think the question I have to the panel is sort of, in a sense, do you have a sense of what models of federalism could be most achievable? Obviously, there's going to be a process of discussion and so on. And how can Iraq be supported in constitution building, echoing the kind of comments which were made earlier about how Kuwait could be sort of investing in Iraq and so on?
Thank you very much. Faisal?
Economic question about the effect of maybe to Dr. Ashaji, the effect of a Gulf security equation on the development effort in each country, especially in Kuwait, this is the economy development and infrastructure development coming from Gulf security equation.
Thank you. Anybody else? No, thank you. Very quick one?
Yeah,
yes, please.
Question to Professor Chandi. I just wanted to check if you would consider the presence of expatriates as a positive element rather than a negative element. Because if the Gulf countries are afraid of Asian countries playing a role in the country, then because of expatriates, I would think that the Asian countries would be more careful about dealing with Gulf situations because of the presence of expatriates. You know, they contribute, for example, about $30 billion is what the remittances are worth today from the 6 GCC countries. And India itself gets about $7 to $8 billion. Plus about 5 million Indians live in the Gulf country. So that dynamic perhaps could play a positive role rather than a negative role.
Thank you. Well, I think because of the time constraint and we have a very short break later on, and then we have the final session at 4 o'clock, we are going to listen to our presenters here backwards, if you like, from Basra to Kuwait. So if you have very direct and quick comment on whatever presented by the questioners.
Thank you. I'll be very brief. Lots of very interesting comments, but it's only two that I have anything to comment on. The first question about Ahwazi's strategical depth to the Basra federalist movement is an interesting idea. The only thing I'd like to say about that is, from the historical perspective, there's been quite a lot of rivalry between Basra and Muhammara. And in the 1920s, certainly Sheikh Hassan was not a friend of the... Well, they were friends at one point, but they later became rivals. And he was trying to do his own thing until 1925, so I think when he was sent to Tehran. as a state prisoner. So I think the reason there's not an historical legacy of cooperation has to do with that. With regard to the federalism question and the federalism models and the various types of federalism in view of what happened in Basra, I would say that what emerges is there is a one-size-fits-all problem in the Iraqi constitution, because the Kurds have been pushing so incredibly hard to weaken the central government. There are other areas of Iraq that are also interested in federalism, but they don't want to go as far as the Kurds want. They like the idea of certainly a central government that's capable of handling the oil sector, for example. So what are the consequences? That would mean for Iraq is either to look at what they've been looking at historically, which is an autonomous Kurdistan and the rest of the country unified under Baghdad, or you could look to Spain, where there is a system where the different regions have different levels of federalism. Not all of them have the same sort of autonomy. Some have more autonomy than others. They have their individual compacts with the capital. So that would be the other model. But what the Basra experience clearly says, the attempt to create a mirror image of Kurdistan has failed and is failing.
That's it?
Yes.
Please.
Okay, thanks. The first question about, I know you directed to Raja, but I also have a historical background with Iraq and the Gulf. As you know, I'm sure, by B.J. Scott's book about Sheikh Mubarak the Great, he was a major landowner in Basra, date palms and date groves. So, of course, the commercial link between Basra and Kuwait has always traditionally been very strong. So that could be something which could be built on in the future, to link it to the question about foreign direct investment. Kuwait and the Gulf states could take a leading role with the capital injections of capital into Basra and to trying to revive these old traditional trading links. I think that could be very important as southern Iraq begins to return to some degree of normality and the Iraqi state begins to kind of re-engage on the Arab scene. So that's just some comments about Basra and Kuwait. Comments about the GCC as an increasingly armed actor in itself. The problem there is, I think, that at a GCC multilateral level, so many defence deals are done bilaterally between GCC and Western countries, United States, France, Britain. It's deals done bilaterally rather than multilaterally, and that's a major problem, I would say, in formulating a multilateral defence policy. Again, Iran is a thorn in the side of the Gulf. Yes, the Gulf can't rely on the US. It can't be the pawn in the middle. At the same time, perhaps a shared interest in Gulf security could be one of the things that brings the US and Iran together. That could be just something. If Obama administration is serious in engaging in some form with Iran, perhaps a shared interest in the security of the Gulf. Again, the internationalization of the Gulf. I think Janardin answered that quite well in his paper this morning. Why is China and India interested? Well, again, it's more muscular deployment to protect energy security, shipping lanes and so on and so forth in the Gulf of Aden in particular.
Along the same lines, I mean, most of the questions were directed to the issue of Gulf security, internationalization of the Gulf, why India, China will be interested in having a more say or more input in terms of Gulf security, and why don't we strike an alliance with Iran rather than go to India or China, as our friend over there has stated. I mean, the problem in this region has been and will always be the lack of indigenous balance of power. We lack balance of power. We collectively, GCC states, cannot balance Iran as we were not able to balance Iraq. And the GCC as an alliance formed in 1981 was supremely and primarily formed as a security organization in response to the devastating Iran-Iraq war that was threatening the Gulf states, mainly Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. We in the Gulf countries still outsource our security, and this is unfortunate. I say it with a great lamentation that after 18 years since the liberation of Kuwait,
we still have not lessened our dependence on outsourcing of that security. We don't have collective security that could, among ourselves, as GCC countries, deter any of the potential adversaries, especially the Iranians. We don't look at Iran as an enemy rather than as some in international relations, as you know, Iran sees a vacuum and would love to fill it. The United States, with its belligerent neocons approach that wrecked the region, toppled the two nemesis of Iran, Saddam Hussein in Iraq and the Taliban in Afghanistan. And naturally that was a huge vacuum, a strategic vacuum at this stage, and the Iranians would love to fill it. Minus United States from this equation, this region will be dominated by the Iranians. What concerns us about Iran is their huge project that stretches from Western Afghanistan into the Gulf. They are consolidating their powers. They have, even now Morocco severed its relation with Iran over Shiaism spreading in that region. So all of that, if you put it in a context, you see that the Iranians have a clear agenda that we are a black, and because of that the Saudis now and other Arab countries, especially Egyptians, the large Arab countries feel that they are threatened and they don't have a strategy, they don't have an approach. Everybody now is clamoring to pull out Syria from Iranian orbit. So I mean, we have really, there have to be confidence building measures. I don't think the Ahmadinejad's government, with all its bellicose, with all its statements that we have been following, is not the Iran that we would like to see doing business with. And this is unfortunate, because you cannot talk about Gulf security and stability in the region from within as long as the major two powers in the region are outside this equation. Iraq, for all practical purposes, is still a country under construction. We don't know what's going to happen to Iraq down the road when the United States pulls out. We now see some kind of normalcy, some signs of normalcy, but will this last? This is a big question. Where Iraq is heading is a major, major issue that is we have to grapple with for the foreseeable future. So excluding the two major players in the region and talking about Gulf security minus Iraq, minus Iran, 6-2 is not the real strategic approach that we would love to see ourselves in. Now, why we're talking about India, why we're talking about China, I'm not saying that this is going to happen, as I stated in my lecture, it's going to happen right away, but I'm saying down the road, because there is a mutual interest, it's a plus-plus, it's a win-win situation for us to diversify our approach. The Indians and the Chinese will have an interest to have not let only the Americans or the West dictate the issue of oil transfer or oil shipments, and their strategic interest could be also an alliance of convenience between the two sides to benefit from each other's needs. Regarding the issue of India, Indian population or Indian expatriates, Jandran's question, I mean, it seems too many Indians or too many expatriates from the same nationality in one country, like for instance in UAE, could be a security threat, for instance. And you're aware of that since you live in UAE. But now there are talks about even some countries are asking for citizenship. India is asking for citizenship in UAE, and there are some talks by labor ministers in the Gulf countries to limit the presence of foreign expatriates for 6 years only, in order not to demand citizenship. Because, as you know, we have three countries in the GCC: Kuwait, UAE, and Qatar, where the native population is a minority, and this is a unique phenomenon. Only in this region we have such a phenomena. So, I mean, all of that, I think, it's be looked upon as Indian role in the region. With its expatriates, it could come to the rescue, as you stated in your presentation. India now, in the strategic approach, will have to come and to defend its citizens or its nationals. So this, I think, throws in some kind of hesitancy and some kind of worrying approach regarding what are the intentions of India's role to have a presence in the region regarding its native population that
that lives in this part. I just want to end with the issue of regional security. I think we are inching by the multipolar world towards a more involvement of not only United States but also of other countries. Now we have NATO, we have the Russians. Oh, we didn't talk about the Russians. Russian role is very, very, very up and coming, and we should also talk about the normal thing that we would love to talk about, 6+2, which unfortunately is not now feasible at this stage. I mean GCC plus two, that's Iraq and Iran, but which Iraq, which Iran, and don't forget Yemen also as an equation or as an added equation to this formula. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would like to thank our panelists. I'm sure that we have benefited of this session, and a few people here were listening patiently to what we are saying, but we'll award you with a very fresh cup of tea now. Thank you.